On the 28th of December 2020, contributed to the conversation, Dr. Tony Ward, History Research Fellow at Melbourne University, published an article entitled "The Less Equal We Become, the Less We Trust Science, and That's a Problem." This article has been republished a number of times and in many countries since it first appeared in the conversation. What Dr. Ward's article claims is that the more unequal our societies, the more people tend to view each other with suspicion and mistrust. The establishment is the villain of the piece because it was all the so-called facts on the ground, based on rationalism and logic, that the unemployed and underemployed blame for having created social inequality. Being willing to experiment by voting in obviously anti-establishment figures like Donald Trump or Boris Johnson is perhaps a sign of this social rebellion. However, when science is questioned, as is currently the case regarding the rollout of anti-COVID vaccines, this has to have a negative impact on general social recovery from the global pandemic. Earlier, we were joined by Tony, and I began by asking him, many people publicly bemoan growing inequality in the advanced economies over the last three decades, most fearing a potential slide into destitution and dystopia. COVID has accelerated this fear, with millions now out of work and older unemployed people unlikely to ever find meaningful paid work again. Obviously, this cohort will be looking for someone to blame. Rationality and those who have used the inevitable logic of the market are at the top of the hit list. Have I missed something here?
Some of that is definitely occurring. I think the bigger impact, and you mentioned both Trump and Boris Johnson, the bigger impact there has been a longer-term shift of people feeling they're being left behind, not necessarily unemployed, but a lot of people who still have jobs but feel that both the economy is passing them by, somehow society is passing them by, and they're being ignored by what they see as the elites.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because, you know, if you go back into the 50s and 60s, you know, the immediate post-war period, you had a lot of people who were very supportive of science and the scientific endeavor, since this basically allowed for the expansion of the middle class and the contraction of poverty. What will it take for former middle class and middle class aspirants to find their way back to adopting this support for science again?
I think there are two things to comment on there. The first is that up until about the early 1980s, and Alan Kohler has recently had some very interesting material on this, the general growth, economic growth of society, was shared reasonably equally. Since the early 80s, most of the benefit of that growth has gone to the top 10%. And so the feeling that people have they're being a bit left behind is quite accurate, that some people are doing significantly better. But I think that has created, if you like, a fertile seedbed for people to be suspicious of elites because they see the top 10% doing very, very well. But I think that has been reinforced and, if you like, has been exploited by some groups in society, and there are the old adage beloved in detective novels of follow the money, which I think was also in the All the President's Men, the story of Watergate. If you follow the money, who benefits out of this dispute of science? And it's fairly quick to see that, for example, the fossil fuel companies have been doing a lot of work to encourage skepticism of science on global warming. And there are a number of other examples of companies that have set to lose because there's more regulation or there's concern about some of their products. And they have been actively saying we're not interested in the science here, or we want to dispute the science. And that I think, has become a much more general trend because there are people like the fossil fuel companies actively organising these things. And the spillovers you get, for example, when the government changed in 2013, the new Liberal National Party coalition government didn't have a Minister for Science, the first time that a Minister for Science wasn't appointed. And I think that indicates a broader disdain for what science can contribute.
I'm glad that you raised political parties here, because, you know, I would imagine that they have a lot to do with the present sense of being left behind. I mean, where are the imaginative young people who have, you know, gone through the parties, both on the left and the right, coming up with all the fabulous ideas to rectify this situation? I don't see them. Do you see them?
I think there is an interest there. I'm reminded a comment Peter Credlin made of the attack on the carbon tax when Tony Abbott and his groups and their allied with the fossil fuel industry to bring down the carbon tax. She said basically that was just brutal retail politics. And here you saw an example of people who saw a political advantage out of pushing, or if you like, jumping on that bandwagon, and that's been the case in the States very much as well. That people, some of the political parties, particularly groups like the Tea Party, have been funded by in big numbers by the Koch brothers and other right-wing business groups. They've made an art form out of disputing science and of criticising anyone they think is coming up with the wrong answers.
What never ceases to amaze me in all of this is how facts that are objectively defined can be denied by people in authority to suit a particular agenda. You know, there used to be a time, certainly when I was much younger, and no doubt, you know, it's a intergenerational issue here, where, you know, if you had someone saying a fact, like, for instance, smoking cigarettes will cause cancer, that would just be something that people would accept because the experts who were, you know, looking into the development of lung cancer in particular were given their say on this matter, you know, based on their expertise, and an expertise that was objectively based. Now, of course, you can say, you know, the sky is green and the grass is blue, and you will have an audience for that. Well, what kind of explains that social phenomenon?
Well, to pick up your point about the smoking and lung cancer connection, the tobacco companies fought for 40 years to deny those scientific links. And any scientific advances have the nature of science. There's always room for dispute. There's room for people to try and work through what alternative explanations there are. But as you say, eventually people decide, yes, the evidence is overwhelming, and which they did for that link between smoking and lung cancer. In fact, the tobacco companies acknowledged that in the late 50s, early 60s, and went on a long period of harvesting every possible doubt that there was. And some of the scientists they used in that, which has been fairly well documented, went on to be skeptics about global warming and other issues. So there are links up between these groups. I think one of the issues, why has this become more widespread? I think there are two things there. Firstly, the number of businesses or the business areas that have been affected by scientific advances have grown, particularly with global warming issues, that the fossil fuel companies are a much wider group of companies and much more linked to the car companies, etc. That's a much bigger organisation base, if you like, than the tobacco companies were. But the second is they're dealing with a more fertile audience because of the inequality issues that we talked about earlier on.
Tony, what is your take on the effect that social media has had in undermining science in the West and elsewhere?
I think there are a couple of things there. One I would say there is an effect, but I don't think it's as significant as these underlying issues we've talked about. One, the change in business, and secondly, the concern over inequality and the, if you like, the populist push against elites. I think that has been reinforced to some extent by social media companies. And one thing to think about, going back to follow the money, one thing that Facebook and organisations like it thrive on is controversy. They want to get as many people clicking on their sites to have a look at the ads that they're running as possible. And it's fairly well documented that the more controversy they stir up, the more people think, oh, I want to have a look at that, or I want to find out a bit more about that, which obviously creates a bigger audience for the ads that that Facebook is running.
I'm John Bruni, and you're listening to The Focus here on Radio Adelaide, and we're speaking with Melbourne University's Dr. Tony Ward on the problems posed by contemporary social inequality. Tony, should science-based companies like Google, Twitter, and Facebook be held at least partially accountable for what we are seeing today with the proliferation of fake news and other conspiracy theories?
Yes, but I'd stress the partial. I think, Twitter has been putting disclaimers on some of its feeds saying this is disputed, or in some cases with coronavirus, it's even stronger than that, saying this is dangerous. Again, it's a partial explanation, and it's certainly reinforced some groups who've been able to get into what people call echo chambers, where you're continually corresponding with like-minded people. But I think that the extent of that has been overestimated in terms of some of the underlying causes.
Tony, I think that if we look at the elites, or the so-called top 10% of society, you know, it's nice that they manage to accumulate as much wealth for themselves, but sure, most of these people are pretty well educated. They must know that their accumulation of wealth just can't go on like this. I mean, they would benefit in the long term far more from a more equitable society.
There's some very good evidence to show that everyone benefits from a more equitable society. There's a group of research comes out from Britain, with started off by Wilkinson and Pickett, and it shows that across the board, more equal societies do better. And in fact, for example, the top 20% in countries like Sweden have much better health results than the top 20% do in the United States, which are much more unequal society. And they relate that to the levels of stress that people have in the society. So there is a lot of support there for saying everyone benefits from more equal societies. It's also very evident that if things don't go as well as you're hoping, even if you're on the top 10%, top 20%, and you do end up on Struggle Street, it's in everyone's benefit to have a decent social safety net there, which some societies do very much better than others. Yeah. I think the critical thing over the last 30, 40 years in a lot of these societies, the top 10% have basically been saying, look, we're going to concentrate on accumulating money and accumulating wealth. And we've seen a spiralling of big salaries and even more so investment returns. That's been a big driving force, and people have been following that rather than thinking about some of these other, if you like, more social issues.
It's interesting. I was just listening to one of Jordan Peterson's podcasts, and he was talking about the fact that, you know, capitalism may not be perfect, but it's probably the best system that humankind has developed in terms of being able to create the mechanisms for social evolution. You know, we have these people, these captains of industry, who can create, you know, the iPhone for us, the Apple Watch, the computers that we're all operating on. You know, this sort of innovative aspect of capital is the thing that actually gives us the very society that we've currently got. But again, you know, if you're looking at capitalism from that perspective, Peterson says that, you may have a top 5% or a top 10% or even a top 20%, but within that cohort, people fall out of that category, other people come in, and that is necessarily a good thing. So how do we find our way back to a more equitable society if we almost say, okay, we've got a stratified society here, we can't really do too much about it, because if we tinker around with it too much, then it becomes like some sort of, well, dare I say, centrally planned nightmare. You know, you're taking away the creativity of those people who have capital to, you know, drive future innovations for the benefit of all of us.
A couple of things there. The first is agreed entirely. I mean, the benefits that we've all seen out of economic and technological advances over the last 100, 150 years have just been massive. There's no disputing that. In fact, they go much further than iPhones and things like that. There is some very interesting research from a New Zealander. Professor Flynn has looked at what has happened to average IQ scores over the last 100 years. And there are all the disputes about what exactly IQ scores measure and so on. But he's found some significant increases in average IQ scores over the last 100 years. So there's an indication that not only are people getting wealthier, they're also getting smarter and healthier. Now, and a lot of that's to do with developments in science, but it's also to do with general social progress, which has been encouraged, I think, by the discoveries that science has made and the exploitation of those by businesses. So yes, tremendous benefits there. The downside is that there have always been a darker side as well. And I think at the moment the darker side and some of those forces are developing more quickly than the benefits we're seeing. And that's something we have to be concerned about, I think.
Tony, finally, what role has democracy had in kicking an own goal on the anti-science phenomenon that we're seeing around us? I mean, we allow freedom of expression, no matter whether factually based, religious opinion, illiberal in nature, and yes, even crackpot theories with or without aliens. Can multiple types of democracies with historically high populations and many being tribalized by identity politics enjoy its democracy cake and COVID vaccine too? Have today's social and economic inequalities created new and dangerous social divisions based on willful and spiteful ignorance?
That's a very big question. a couple of answers, and I don't think we can do it full justice. But the first is Winston Churchill's old quote that democracy is the worst form of government except for everything else that's been tried. I think there's a lot of value in ensuring that democratic norms are obeyed and we don't get some of the things that Donald Trump's trying to do in the States at the moment. Those quick steps towards tyranny, I think. Yeah. In terms of social divisions, yes, there are some, but if you look back a couple of years, we had an amazing turnout in Australia for the referendum on same-sex marriage. And there are positive signs there as well. People will get involved if they see something as being important to them. And if there's some decent organisation, you referred earlier one of your questions to where are the young people? There was a tremendous involvement of young people in that same-sex marriage referendum. And there's a lot of enthusiasm for some other things, such as action on climate change. And in those areas, I think there's some real grounds for optimism.
Melbourne University's Dr. Tony Ward. You're listening to The Focus on Radio Adelaide.